welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, PJ O'Rourke's hunting dog, Andrew Heaton. And today we're going to have a fun show. Kathy Reisenwitz is on. We're going to talk about sex-positive feminism and the types of feminism there. And afterwards, on a completely unrelated note, I am going to pitch myself to The Bachelor as the next Bachelor. So if you're a producer for The Bachelor, be sure to listen to that part. But before we do either of those things, we do need to pay the bills, and that means a word to our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Snuffy's off Route 44, the diner where all of the waiters and waitresses take your order and deliver your food to you on horseback. What grand romantic gesture are you planning this year for Valentine's Day? Chocolate? Flowers? Interesting sex positions? Those are a good start. But top billing always goes to breakfast in bed. It's comfortable, romantic, and really shows your lover that you care about them. And, of course, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Now, if you want, you can lowball a romantic breakfast. Maybe cobble together some waffles, scramble some eggs, that sort of thing. But don't you really want to knock it out of the park with an impressive meal? Well, good news. Now through this weekend, Snuffy's is offering a special Valentine's Day breakfast in bed service. Place your order in lickety-split. Snuffy's will send over a delicious breakfast and then serve it to your wife or husband from a horse. Just imagine the joy and surprise they'll have when they open their eyes to see a perfect stranger in the bedroom holding a steaming plate of calf fry omelets seated on a horse. Nothing says I love you like inviting a stranger on horseback into your bedroom to surprise your paramour with freshly squeezed orange juice and a stack of peanut butter Ovaltine flapjacks. Make this Valentine's Day special. Make this year Snuffy's in bed. And if you want the chance to win a free dinner at Snuffy's, call and leave a review of your last dining experience there at 844-SNUFFY'S. That's 844-768-3397. The wait staff will pick a winner, and I will play that voicemail on Friday, and they will get a free dinner at all of our favorite equestrian diner. Snuffy's off Route 44, because everything tastes better from a horse. My guest today is Kathy Reisenwitz. She is the housing columnist at the Bay City Beacon, and she blogs at Sex and the State. And we've known each other for a few years through various D.C. circles, including a web series, and have done some comedic stuff, too. Kathy, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
The reason that I wanted to bring on Kathy is that I've had a few emails, and I've seen a lot of feminist and anti-feminist literature and kind of slap fights on Twitter of late, and it confused me to some extent because I kind of thought we all qualified as such. My understanding of feminism, which I'm going to kick over to Kathy momentarily, is that broadly speaking, it means that women should have equal respect, opportunity, and equality before the law, which I am 100% on board for. But I'm seeing more and more of this kind of feminist and anti-feminist camp, and I'm frankly confused as to where those barriers are and what the clear delineations are. And I suspect that there's probably a lot of people talking over each other. And so I wanted to invite on somebody that I knew knows what they're talking about, and that would definitely be Kathy. So Kathy, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So can you walk me through, is my definition of feminism pretty close?
Yeah, I think it's good. I think feminism is the radical notion that women are people. Okay. And I think it is, as an ideology, that's kind of what it holds. And then I think that as a movement, feminism is the movement against sexism.
Okay.
And so that's sexism in all its forms, against men, against women, against trans people, against discrimination and negative assumptions on the basis of sex or gender.
Okay. Well, so far, I'm completely on board with this. And I've, you know, I read your website periodically, and I've paid attention to a lot of the writings you've done. You describe yourself as a sex positive feminist, and I will admit, I've got a kind of working definition of feminism. That's where my understanding of feminism basically stops. Is I don't know all of the various. I did some research in preparation for this interview. There seems to be 11 or so schools of thought within the feminist movement. I do not know what they are. However, you are a sex positive feminist. What is that?
So you didn't find that in the Rockwell painting? Essentially, like, sex-positive feminism is a reaction to radical feminism. Very few feminists would describe themselves as sex-negative. More would describe themselves as sex-critical. But essentially, Sex positive feminism is a bit of a misnomer. It doesn't hold that sex is good. It holds that sex is inherently morally neutral, which means that
I was kind of rooting for the inherently sex is good thing, but okay, please continue.
Yeah, it can be for you, and it is for me, but it doesn't have to be for everyone.
Oh, okay.
So I think like sex negative feminists make a lot of good points that, you know, we live in a patriarchy, we live in sexism, and that power dynamics influence how people experience sex. I think sex for a lot of people, whether due to trauma or biology, is not a fun experience for them. And that's fine. Like that is just as acceptable and okay as sex being fun and good. But the idea is that if we accept that sex is inherently morally neutral, then we accept that the way that people experience sex is acceptable and okay, right? That if I experience sex as pleasurable outside of the context that you experience sex as pleasurable, for example, outside of a heterosexual, monogamous, lifelong, you know, partnership, that's not inherently immoral.
Okay.
If I experience, you know, sex as pleasurable, you know, within BDSM, like that's not inherently immoral. And it goes further to say that the difference in the inherent moral value of me trading my labor for money, you know, making you lattes, is not inherently morally different than me trading my labor in the form of sex for money. That sex isn't magic, right? It's a thing that we do. It's a bodily function, and that the meaning that we put on sex is meaning that we put on sex, not meaning that sex is, you know, always and necessarily having. Does that make sense?
I follow you. And to back up a little bit, you said that most people would not describe themselves as sex negative, but as sex critical. Would that be, I assume that exists out with feminism as well, where if you are from a particularly socially conservative background, you might view sex as inherently negative outside the confines of a monogamous relationship. And then presumably there is a subset of feminism that views sex as negative because it's part of the patriarchy, or it could be exploitative or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So these two kinds of groups, often what they have in common is this idea that sex is inherently one thing or another, and that whatever they see sex as is what it is, and that everyone else that doesn't see it that way is wrong.
Okay.
And that's what sex positivity seeks to correct, that you can see sex however you want to see it, but once you start applying that view to me and saying the way I see it is wrong, that's where we run into trouble.
Okay. All right. I follow you so far. So if someone viewed sex, and I think that this is probably an extreme minority opinion, but if someone, I've read before, certain academics will say that all heterosexual sex is inherently exploitative. And were they to project that experience onto me, I would go, you know, the many, many, many sex partners that I have on a regular basis, I feel that, you know, this is fun for both parties and it's not exploitative. And the only people that are defining the value or misvalue of it is me and the person I'm having sex with. It's not an external thing that you get to project. Am I coming near the mark?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I would say it's a little more nuanced than that, but sure. Yeah. Essentially, like, sex, you don't get to tell me how I experience sex.
That,
you know,
seems fair to me.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. I've become a hedonist in my 30s, where I'm kind of, are you hurting anyone? Okay. Are you still mowing your lawn? Great. All right. Then do whatever you want. As long as you're mowing your lawn and you're not, you know, reducing property value or, more importantly, hurting anybody, then, like, you know, if you want to, like, wear a costume or something, that's great. Like, you know, good luck. Maybe I'll sell the costume to you and make a buck off of this.
As a sex positive feminist urbanist, I'm far more offended by you having a lawn than any kind of sex you could have.
If it makes you feel better, I don't yet have a lawn. I'm projecting into the future where I believe I will be. At some point, I'll have that lawn and I'll have a dog. These are part of my goals. To back up a minute ago, you mentioned radical feminism. This would be one of the schools of feminism that I read about. I could entirely be wrong about this, but I think when I hear people say they hate feminism or they're not feminists, they're anti-feminists, I think a lot of the time they're referring either to misandry or disliking men, or they're referring to radical feminism, but maybe not feminism as a whole. What do you think about that? And actually, can you define radical feminism for me?
Yeah. So radical feminism does not mean super feminist. It doesn't mean I'm real into women being people. It means that it's a specific kind of subgroup of feminism. And it tends to correlate with feminists who are, they exclude trans women from their feminism and they exclude sex workers from their feminism. They tend to be the more, misandrist wing of feminism. But to make a larger point, and I think this is probably the one thing that I want people to understand about feminism, is that anytime you have an ideology and you have people who are against that ideology, they're always going to find the most insane representatives and put them out like, oh, this is what feminism is. Like, this crazy person is saying something and calling themselves a feminist. That's what feminism is. I mean, look at the way that libertarians are presented by people who oppose libertarianism.
Yeah, it's a naked guy at a podium holding a gun, like, you know, throwing pamphlets about. Yes, I've seen rather cartoon caricatures of libertarians a lot and encountered such in dialogue as well.
Absolutely. And that guy exists and he's, you know, he's a libertarian, but to act like that represents libertarianism as an ideology is insane. And so if the only view of feminists that you're getting is from people who are cherry picking the craziest feminists, don't get all your information on an ideology from people who oppose the ideology.
Yeah.
Like just straight up.
That sounds fair to me. Well, and again, I go back to my original point on this. Maybe I just completely missed out on a decade or something, but I kind of thought we were all feminists at this point because the baseline of feminism is just women are equally deserving of social status, property rights, equality of law, equality of opportunity. Just you know, everybody should be equal on some fundamental level. And I think most Americans feel that way, even if they wouldn't describe themselves as feminists. But I think that broadly speaking encompasses most of us. And so I think that the terms are kind of getting muddled in a proxy battle between kind of culture war folks. I don't think it necessarily needs to be.
No, I think it's completely unnecessary. I think if I could summarize what I think is happening with opposition to feminism is that people are seeing a lot of changes in society that they do not like. For example,
lady doctors.
So men's wages have stagnated since the 1970s. Men in the lower half of the income distribution, their wages have stagnated. Women's have increased. Women are earning more degrees, and degrees are becoming more necessary for a middle income lifestyle. Women are set to out earn. The average woman is set to out earn the average man by 2025.
Awesome to me because I'm not married yet. That sounds like I'm going to upgrade in terms of income brackets. So like that's terrific.
Absolutely.
Ladies, like keep earning more money.
Yeah, I agree. But for a certain subset of the population, and this is actually most people prefer a man to earn at least slightly less than a woman. And it's just not economically feasible for people at the lower end of the income spectrum increasingly. And so people essentially are angry at women for competing with men in the workplace and out-competing them. Mm-hmm. And so they want to blame feminism. And then there's the other aspect of, you know, because we have, I believe it's like, I don't know, a huge proportion of men between the ages of 18 and like 35 who are not in the labor force and not in school. Like they're just not doing anything. And so, you know, you look at the explosion in the percentage of babies born to single mothers, and conservatives want to say like, oh, you know, this is feminism. Like women just don't want to get married. When the truth is like, there literally aren't enough breadwinners to go around. A woman marrying a man without a job, just like men are also less likely than women. Even if men work much fewer hours, like they still don't do as many hours of childcare and domestic labor. Mm-hmm. So if a man marries an unemployed woman and she has a child, like that's just another burden on her. That doesn't lift her out of poverty. And so there's just a lot of like blame of women and feminism for what's happened to men when it's actually like much bigger, like socioeconomic governmental, societal shifts, I think that feminism is, it came after the shift of our economy from manufacturing and agriculture to information and services, right? That opened up demand for women in the workforce. And women also simply like...
Part of what you're saying that I think we ought to throw out there is that if people are angry at women for earning more, I think that's predicated on a zero-sum model of there's only so much wealth to go around. Therefore, if a particular group is earning more, it must be at the expense of another group, which I do not agree with. I think that is a very bad way of looking at economics. And I see that as really skewing a lot of otherwise good conversations about how to fix things. So I could see that kind of playing into it, where the economy is growing and a demographic within it's growing faster. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're stealing shares from another portion of the economy.
No, absolutely not. Jobs are not fixed. If men want to train in information and service-based jobs, like, they exist and they need these men. But these men are not taking advantage of these opportunities, and women are. And so they're not taking advantage of the opportunities, and then they're blaming women for taking advantage of them. And then they're blaming feminism for giving women the temerity to find jobs. And it's just really unfortunate. Mm.
What are the flashpoints in feminism? Because again, me having a very basic understanding of feminism and not knowing the nuance or the schools of feminism or the academic side of it, I would be surprised if internally feminism is one homogenous, happy ideology in which everyone has minor quibbles but totally agrees on all the main stuff. I suspect there are internal flashpoints. Am I right in thinking that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I'm not really, like, I have what I'm interested in, and so I'm sure someone with different interests would say the controversies are completely different, but to me, the big controversies are, I wouldn't even say, like, capitalism is a controversy. I would say, like, 90% of feminists are pretty, meh to negative on capitalism, which I think is really unfortunate.
So meh would be like a 4 on the 10 scale? Of like slightly below neutral and one being a let's have a socialist revolution.
Yeah, basically, okay. Unfortunately.
That does worry me a little bit.
I wouldn't even say that's controversy.
I'll say that does.
Love it.
Yeah, that makes me go, I'm not sure then. Maybe, there's less overlap than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's absolutely nothing contradictory about capitalism and feminism. And I just think that for a bunch of reasons, I think mostly having to do with, women being particularly poorly treated by the labor market and feminism being, a very academic endeavor. You know, there's some tensions there that are not necessary, but just are kind of cultural artifacts. But anyway, I would say that the bigger tensions, the more active tensions are between, the sex worker exclusionary and trans exclusionary feminists and the, I would just call them just feminists, or you could call them sex positive feminists or inclusionary feminists. But yeah, there are feminists who want to, who think sex is magic, right? And think that, being paid to make a latte is, just kind of capitalism, but being paid to give a blowjob is like rape and trauma and like an emergency. And it's just like, you're hung up on sex and that's chill. Like, you're allowed to be, but calling the cops to stop me from, doing sex work is really problematic. Like, it's extremely, It's so anti-feminist, right? Because it reduces my agency as a woman to choose how I want to make money. It's just like...
There's a weird kind of internal contradiction there where if you're going to be, from my vantage point, if you're going to be very much in favor of women having reproductive rights and you're going to be very pro-choice and it's all predicated on a woman owns her body, she controls her body, but then also go, but at the same time, though, you can't use your body for specific things that we believe are deleterious to you and that we think are a besmirch against your dignity as defined by us. That I kind of look at that and go, well, hold on. Isn't the central tenet of this that the woman owns herself? and that the action she's doing should be based on her and not on us. And I see the kind of odd overlap there. A few years ago, when I was living in Edinburgh, I had a roommate who wanted to, she really wanted to shut down, or I guess it was a flatmate since this was in Scotland. She wanted to shut down the strip clubs in Scotland in Edinburgh because she thought that they were inherently sexist, and she wanted to go to the city council and have them disband these things. And I think my attitude at the time was, this is not the hill I'm going to die on. I'm like, I live with this person. I don't really want to fight about this. I'm going to go in my room and play Civilization 4 or whatever. I took the coward's way out. But I did kind of look at that and go, well, I feel very odd as, I'm not going to say a man, just as a person, telling a woman what she can and can't do with her body. And then to also claim that is a feminist tenet, that we're going to, in her case, shut down a strip club because we're feminists. I thought that's a very odd way to approach it from my vantage point.
I mean, if you can't sell it, you don't own it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. To go back to an earlier thing you said, Kathy, because you said that you're an inclusionary feminist, which is one of the things I enjoy about your writing. One of the kind of themes that I pick up on when I read articles by you, and you're a very good writer. I enjoy reading your stuff. I say that for the benefit of my listeners. One of the things I pick up in it is I never get the hint from you that you don't like men or that you're anti-men. In fact, I get the opposite from you. I get the impression that you view feminism as primarily combating sexism, and you see sexism as hurting both men and women. You don't see it as sort of a rebalancing where we topple men in order to bring women up, but rather I get the impression you think men are also getting screwed over by sexist policies.
Absolutely. I love men. I have a lot of empathy for men as well, and I think that sexism is absolutely as damaging to men as it is to women. And it's unfortunate that the way that anti-feminists have framed the debate, like, there is no need for men's rights activists. Like, men's rights
is that MRA? Because I've had a few people write into me about MRA, and I wasn't sure what the, like, when I Googled it, Google told me it was like meal readies, or it was like prepper meals. And I was like, I don't think that's what they're writing about, although I will invest in it because I'm always ready for the apocalypse. Okay, so MRA, men's rights activists, right? Okay.
Yeah, like, for example, sexism tells men that there's certain kinds of work that are for men and certain kinds of work that are for women. This is hurting men's ability to enter into the workforce and be able to provide for themselves and families, right?
Mm-hmm. Pushes men towards more dangerous jobs. I suspect that there's probably a fair amount of psychological torture going on where if a male is under an extreme obligation to perform not what he wants to do, but rather a societal expectation, that's probably going to have an emotional effect or a psychological effect of I'm failing to live up to a particular standard. So I could see that having blowback even in a system that, you know, is otherwise going to benefit men at the top.
Absolutely. And the fact that men are, you know, heavily stigmatized when they show emotion, when they cry, when they non-sexually touch other men, when they, you know, do anything regarded as feminine is really stunting to men. It's really keeps them lonely and isolated and frustrated. And masculinity, I don't know, it feels a lot of times like conservatives love masculinity more than they love men. You know, they're not able to critically look at the way these expectations to perform masculinity are keeping men from living like full, healthy, productive lives.
Hmm. To go back a little bit, you mentioned that a large percentage of feminists would be meh to anti-capitalist. Is there am I right in thinking then there's not a direct correlation between Marxism and feminism or socialism and feminism, but there's a very high correlation between the two? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think that within Marxism, you've had more of an opportunity to question things like the nuclear family, the nuclear heterosexual family with a male breadwinner, mm-hmm. Which has kind of overlapped with feminism. But beyond that, I don't think that there's any real need to correlate the two anymore. I just think it just so happens that the people who are into feminism are tend to be. The other thing, though, which I think is more important and something we could actually do something about, is that unfortunately, there is a huge overlap between being sympathetic to free market ideas and being anti-feminist. And this is something that I've encountered a whole lot working first more within the free market sphere and then increasingly in the feminist sphere. You know, I started writing about libertarianism and then kind of looked around and was like, oh, there's, you know, not a ton of women here. You know, why is that? And so I started writing about feminism with the intent to bring more women on board, and then got like this huge continual backlash from self-described libertarians.
This also displeases me. This is also a disconcerting revelation.
Yeah, it was for me too. I was very naive going into it. To me, there's nothing incompatible between libertarianism and feminism. And so I was like, oh, this is an area that libertarianism has, you know, to my thinking, just kind of neglected. So let me fill in this gap. I mean, I didn't know how much work had been done, and a lot of work has been done, and I've discovered it as I went along. But, you know, I started doing it, and the backlash was just the anger and the, you know, was just really surprising to me. And so I think, honestly, you know, if we're looking at why feminism is so hostile to capitalism, we need to look at why capitalists are so hostile to feminism.
That's fascinating, and something that I had not thought about. And I've wondered about this. Like, I did some research where I looked at, you know, what is the balance in terms of gender disparity between parties. And I think the Democratic Party has maybe a 10-point lead over Republicans in terms of women who view themselves as Democrats. There's about 10% more women who view themselves as Democrats than Republicans. So they've got a lead there. But when it gets to the Libertarian Party, or I shouldn't say the party, self-described Libertarians, it was something like, I looked at a Pew poll that they did in 2016, and it had, I think, maybe 37% of self-described Libertarians were women, and what would that be, 63% were men. There was probably some amount that refused, just being Libertarians. I'm sure there was an element of that that just refused to answer the question. But at the same time, though, I looked at it and went, okay, there is a very heavy male skewing. And I had wondered, I had Jonathan Haidt on the program about 2 months back, and he had said that classical liberalism tends to be a hyper-male way of thought, and that was sort of his explanation for it. But you're positing that there is just a lot of misogyny at present in free market circles that might explain why it's not a receptive place for women?
I mean, I think it's like, that's kind of the what's a nice word for this? It's easy. It's the easy way out to say, oh, women's brains are just not, you know, whatever, logical or whatever enough for libertarianism. And that may or may not be true, but we can't do anything about that. Mm-hmm. But we can do something about the misogyny in libertarianism. Mm-hmm. We can do something about the fact that libertarians are openly hostile to feminists. Okay. We can do something about the fact that we deprioritize things like sex work legalization over like the gold standard, right? Like, so if we want to just chalk it up to like, oh, women's lady brains just can't do libertarianism, like, okay, that gets you off the hook, you know, and it's kind of misogynist. But if we want to fix the problem, then we need to focus on where we can do better as a movement.
Okay. And out of curiosity, would you see that more as a policy focus? Would you see that more as a cultural shift where if you know, people are being sexist, you call them out on it? Like, what do you think would be the most beneficial way to bring in more women?
Yeah, all of it. All of it. Yeah. Fund organizations like Feminists for Liberty, Association of Libertarian Feminists, you know.
So I should not publish my book called 30 Reasons to Hate Women and Also Love the Gold Standard. I should go ahead and scuttle that. All right. I'm gonna take that one out then. I'll get rid of that. Before I forget, I want to back up a little bit because I have had a couple people email me about MRA. And you said we don't have a need for that. Can you unpack that?
No, I'm not saying we don't have a need for it. I do think that in feminism, men's needs are probably under talked about. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that the better way, like, I look at feminism and I'm like, okay, I have a lot of problems with it. It's too hostile to capitalism. It doesn't focus on men's issues enough. It is sex negative. It is trans exclusionary. And then I say, okay, the core tenets of feminism are right. Women are people. Sexism is bad. So I'm going to get in there and make it better, right? Mm-hmm. And so to me, like, if you're a man and you're concerned about sexism, join feminism, like, make it better. It doesn't need a separate movement. I mean, it's the same with libertarianism. Like, when I got into libertarianism, I was like, oh, this is hostile to women and ignores race and class. And, like, it's got its problems, but, like, let's make it better. Mm. And I publicly quit libertarianism several times. But, like, at the end of the day, you know, I think the core tenets of libertarianism are good. And I think the core tenets of feminism are good. And so I would just kind of exhort MRAs to, you know, see feminism as your ally, because at the end of the day, like, we're trying to defeat sexism and you're trying to defeat sexism. Yeah. And so there's no reason for us to be at odds.
I think I have a very similar position to you. I'll sum it up with a Oklahoma aphorism, which has struck near and dear to my heart. I was I was about to say debate. I'm confident this was just a bar chat. But I was in a bar chat in some Oklahoma town a few years ago, and someone was discussing, they were talking about how if you are if you're a husband going through a divorce, you're far less likely to get custody of the kids. And that is part of our legal system has a kind of 19th century, early 20th century hanger-on of, well, women should be at home with the kids, men should be out earning, therefore we're going to just default on the woman. And this person was complaining about that, and then there was somebody else that was like, you know, shut up. You have it so great. You shouldn't even be concerned. And the guy at the table went, injustice is not a pissing match. And I went, I think that's exactly where I'm at. Injustice is not a pissing match. Because if you bring up, hey, something bad's happening over here, it doesn't negate from the bad thing happening in the first room. And it's not a contest to see which one of these things is worse. It's just pointing out that there's a bad thing that we should fix. And I don't think they necessarily need to be at odds with one another.
No, I think the more you can work with people and the less you can work against them, the more effective you're going to be.
That is near and dear to my strategy. So I want to run through some terms with you because they come up a lot, and I want to make sure that I've got an understanding of them. We've already talked about MRA. Tell me what talk to me about the patriarchy, because I hear this term a lot, and I don't know whether this is generally meant to refer to a specific group of men, as in, you know, like, what? Whether this refers to a specific group of men or whether this refers to all men, as in I am a member of the patriarchy, or whether the patriarchy is a kind of an algorithm of ideas. I'm not sure. So what are your thoughts on the patriarchy? Does it exist, and what is it?
I think the patriarchy is just a word to describe a kind of collection of phenomena. Like, it's not really about, oh, he's the patriarch. I mean, you can say that in a funny way, but it's not really about that. It's, to me, it's like, okay, what have we observed in reality, right? So one thing that we've observed is that a woman and a resume with exactly equal qualifications, you know, the woman is presumed to be less competent.
And they've done blind tests on that too. You're not just hypothesizing. They've done empirical studies where they swap names out and will apply at various jobs, and they find that that's the case. Yeah.
Right. And that in a group setting, a woman is more likely to be talked over than a man, right? That women are penalized as the same behavior exhibited by a man and a woman. Women are seen as, you know, negative and bitchy for doing the exact same things as men. Like, you know, the fact that a woman is losing access to reproductive health care in the United States day by day, that in some parts of the country, women have to undergo multiple 14-hour bus rides, a transvaginal ultrasound, so a wand in her vagina, before she's allowed to make a choice about her body. You know, I could go on, like, the fact that women are routinely accused of lying, and encouraged to not report, not press charges against their rapists by police officers. The fact that sex workers are routinely raped by police officers. Like, I could go freaking on. So these are all things that are, like, happening, right? So how do we describe this reality? What's the word that we could use to, like, kind of sum up the way that women and men interact with each other?
So if I'm reading this correctly, you're saying the patriarchy is a matrix of ideas and systems and bias. It's not so much a collection of people. It's more of
exactly
sort of, which makes more sense to me, because I kind of where I balk when the patriarchy come up, when it comes up, when I tend to recoil, is I do have friends that talk about male privilege and the patriarchy as if it is a monolithic group in which all men are equally participating. And I dated a woman a few years ago who heard she can't call her father because he's too poor to own a phone. He literally doesn't own a phone. If she needs to get a hold of him, she has to call a neighbor or send him a letter. And I think about that guy. I've not met him, but I know what part of the he's from a part of Oklahoma I'm familiar with. And I think to accuse that guy of being part of this sort of tippy top of the pyramid, I think is disingenuous, and I can understand why that would very much irk him. So in describing it more as a system rather than a sort of Illuminati with gonads makes more sense to me.
Well, and women are
Although I will say Illuminati with gonads sounds like a pretty good improv team name, and I'm going to make a note to myself that if I start one in Dallas, that might be what I go up with.
I mean, women perpetrate patriarchy as much as men do, you know? Mm-hmm. Women make these assumptions. Women interrupt other women more than women interrupt men.
One of the things that I found in your writing, Kathy, is you mentioned the likability gap. What is that?
Yeah, it's just the thing I was talking about how when a man is direct and straightforward, he is seen as a good leader and competent. And when a woman is direct and straightforward, or when a man asks for more money or, you know, does these things that are, you know, inherently kind of value neutral, he's seen positively. But when a woman does the same behaviors, she's seen negatively.
Okay.
She's seen as less likable for the same behavior.
And then so on the end of thinking about this and projecting how to benefit society, it would seem to me then that having a universal standard would be a good thing, where that's another one of the things where I tend to get I don't really like getting into culture war stuff. I just don't feel like that's my fight. But one of the things that I do find frustrating a lot of the time is that I am very inclined towards universalist systems where there is a standard and rule of law, or a cultural standard and rule of law, and it's equally applied to everybody. And when we start carving out exceptions where there's some kind of hierarchy of, well, this person, this rule applies to them because they're X group, this rule doesn't apply to this person because they're Y group, that kind of irks me. So if it's just like I should treat men and women equally, or dislike the same thing in men and women, or like the same thing in men and women, I'm fine with that. That sounds like a pretty good system to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just like, examine your biases. Like, if you have an interaction with a woman and think like, oh, she's being a bitch, like, think about like, okay, if she'd been a man and done the exact same thing, or when men have done the exact same thing, did you feel like the same way? And if you did, fine, like, maybe she's being a bitch. But if empirical evidence is any indication, there are a lot of times when we are judging women more harshly than men for the same behaviors. And so I think it's up to us as individuals to become aware of these problematic biases and like work to overcome them, because punishing women for behavior that's adaptive in men, I think is going to just lead to everybody, like, and it has led to everybody being poorer and more confused. Women have a lot to offer the world and in the workplace, and it makes it harder for us to just create value and do our jobs when we are subjected to these not useful double standards.
Okay. One of the things that I think is one of the biggest elements of pushback against feminism or perceived feminism is a thought of misandry or intense anger or anti-maleness. I mean, you'd kind of alluded to this at the beginning of the program, that you think that a lot of that's cherry-picking. How pervasive would you say anti-maleness is within feminism? Is that a minority position? Is that something that's unique to specific schools in feminism, or is it just cherry picking?
I would say that a lot of the anti-male sentiment is joking, and I'm not going to say like, oh, it's just a joke. So it like, no, I mean, jokes matter, but I think if you're not like in it, it's hard to see what's a joke and what's serious. And I think that a lot of that cherry picking is taking those jokes and presenting them as if they were said earnestly.
Which I have to say, to go back to the universal thing, this is where I kind of... Did you see the Gillette controversy of, you know, how to be a better man and all that that came out maybe a month ago? I watched that, and I saw a ton of people get really worked up over it, really angry at it. And I went, well, hold on. Like, the way I usually approach these situations is I try not to be telepathic. I try not to go, you know what they really mean? What they really mean is this. I try not to do that because I try and be charitable in my interpretation of what people say and create. And I also try not to get ruffled. And so if I'm going to do that, if, say, somebody says a joke and they have an Asian accent and everyone's saying they are the most, they're Hitler. And I'm going, okay, like there was a joke. There was nothing in the joke that was anti-Asian. I think we can all kind of calm down on this one. If I'm going to take that approach of it's just a joke, then I would say I'd probably need to do that when it flips around and we're making fun of a dad in a sitcom or something for being a goofy dad of, okay, either we're all going to enter the sphere where we need to glean the deeper meaning and grow angry from it in humor, or we have to take a step back, be a little bit more stoic, be a little bit more thicker skinned. But it's a good point.
Well, I think what's complicated about humor is that I subscribe to a very strong idea of punching up. I think jokes should punch up. And I think that a lot of feminists would say a joke, against men is punching up because men are overrepresented in positions of power when it comes to, CEOs, founders, board members, Congress people, any kind of position of power that you can imagine women are underrepresented relative to men. However, on the bottom end of the income and power scale, that's not really true. Men are overrepresented in positions of less power. Like in a lot of situations, they're less likely to be employed. They're less likely to have health insurance. They're more likely to be in prison, more likely to be injured on the job, more likely to be on disability. So I think that gone are the days when jokes about men as a gender are punching up, because I think a lot of men are not in positions of power relative to women. I mean, even men at the bottom still benefit from things like the likability gap and gendered expectations, but they also are hurt by a lot of sexism at the same time.
I think you raise a very good point. That's something that's oftentimes left out of these conversations is that yes, the top leaders in corporate structures and in government are males, but also the very bottom tends to be male. Whereas women, it's more like a bell curve where it's less likely to be at the very top, but less likely to be at the very bottom. That's one of the things I kind of recoil from in a lot of these gender conversations is I really don't like treating people. I don't like treating demographics like billiard balls, where if you are X, then you're just part of this monolithic structure. There's more nuance to that. When it comes to things like privilege, I look at, say, the aforementioned ex-girlfriend's dad, and I'm like, I can't fathom that he is in a grand societal way more privileged than one of my friends that's like an Ivy League woman who has tons of connections and knows how to rub elbows with congressmen and stuff. There might be certain advantages he has, but to sort of foist onto him every bad thing that a Wall Street executive is doing is sort of denouncing any form of individuality and just sort of treating a massive block. I don't like that. And I'll also say, just as a humorist, I hear that the phrase you use, punching up, is a very common one in the New York City comedy scene right now. It's become even more so during the Trump years. And the concern, not even the concern there, this isn't even a moral or a culture thing. It's just as a guy that writes jokes, I hear that and I'm like, why does comedy have to be punching? I'm not a combative guy. I don't like punching. I'm much more into absurdist humor. I love Monty Python and Dave Barry and stuff like that. I don't look at my humor as a weaponized form of comedy where I'm trying to take down people. And I look at that and I'm like, I don't see that much good coming out of it. If it's going to be punching, punch up. But I'd rather just make weird Dadaist jokes about horses.
Yeah, I love that about your humor, actually.
Thank you.
It's true.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So we'll wind it down here in a few minutes. I want to talk to you about the wage gap a little bit. What are your thoughts on the wage gap?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been oversimplified and weaponized by both sides. I think that, so, okay, let's go through the facts. The facts are a white woman, or maybe just women in total, makes 77 cents for a man's dollar for the same job, okay. Right? I believe it's the same job. And then if you, something that is understated is that Black and Latino women make far less than that. And so conservatives or anti-feminists will say, well, once you account for college degree, time in the workforce, hours worked, and other such factors that should impact salary, the wage gap all but disappears. And to that, I would say, like, you are factually correct. That's true. But that ignores why there's a gap in hours worked, degree chosen, time in the workforce, right? All of those things aren't just, oh, women just happen to be making those choices. Women are pressured into and expected to make those choices. Women are expected to and stigmatized if they fail to make choices that lead to them having lower salaries, right? So, like, for example, you know, women who enter into male-dominated, you know, degree programs are often have to deal with sexism and their professors doubting them. There was a really great podcast. It was the neoliberal podcast, which I highly recommend. And I forget her name, but she was a female economist talking about like her experience getting a economics degree. I think it's important to listen to women's experience of trying to get those male-dominated degrees. All right, so that's your degree. And then when it comes to higher education, you know, women's fertility means that it's very difficult for them to get through, you know, for example, a PhD program and then have very many years of reproductive life left. Okay, so that's getting in their way. And then when they enter the workforce, women are expected to take on the bulk of childcare and domestic responsibilities. So, you know, if it's going to get done and a woman has to do it, she can't work as many hours because she needs to spend those hours doing the things that she's expected to do at home. And then when a child comes along or a parent gets sick or, you know, something happens that someone needs to leave the workforce for a number of years, women are expected to be the ones to leave the workforce. And so to say that, you know, the wage gap has nothing to do with sexism, sure, the wage gap does not result from discrimination at the, you know, hiring level where men or women are sitting there saying like, I'm not going to hire women for these roles or I'm going to pay women less. Women are also less likely to ask for as much money as men are because women face, you know, stigma when they ask for money that men don't face, right? But to say that sexism doesn't play a role in the wage gap is wrong. Like it does. It's just in subtler ways.
I wish we would call it the income gap. I think that you identified what I view as the primary thing in that. And I trace it back mostly to college because we call it a wage gap, and I think income gap is a better description because as I understand it, job for job, there's not much. There is something of a wage gap, but it's very tiny. Like if you're comparing male doctors to female doctors, the variance is like maybe 2 to 3%. If you're comparing male bus drivers to female bus drivers, the variance is 2 to 3%. So it's very minimal on a lateral level, but the larger amount of distribution gap occurs because there are far more men in high paying jobs like engineering and Wall Street, and far more women in low-paying jobs like being a teacher or being a social worker and that kind of thing. And so I look and go, well, and then the inflection point for that would appear to be in education, either in high school or in college, in terms of why women are going into that. And at that point, I don't know. I think that there could be a dynamic of, you know, maybe men are more inclined to work with numbers and less inclined to work with people. Maybe women on average are going to be more desirous of jobs involving empathy. But at the same time, I could also see a societal pressure being there of like, hey, like you need to go into teaching, you're a woman, or you know, math's not for girls, don't go into engineering. And I don't really know. My only contribution to the whole thing is just kind of looking at it and going, there's sort of a deeper meta picture going on, which is the income gap itself.
Well, and I think we cannot underestimate the impact of getting married and having kids on women's incomes. Hmm. So there's evidence that women earn about the same as men until they get married and have kids. And then their earnings drop precipitously. But even when you talk about, like, you know, women's brains being more, you know, geared toward empathy, women are, from a very young age, girls are expected to display empathy to a greater degree than boys are. Hmm. So, you know, girls are socialized to be good at considering other people's feelings in a way that boys aren't. And so, of course, that's going to influence the kinds of jobs that they can be qualified for. But I think more than anything, this hurts men because today's jobs more and more require empathy, and men are not being socialized to learn how to display it.
Interesting. We'll end it there. Let's see. I think do you want to give another plug for the biggest misconceptions likely to accompany feminism, or any lasting words you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, like, feminism at its core should be absolutely non-controversial, and that to the extent that it seems controversial to you, like, examine your biases and your prejudices and, like, get informed. And one great way to get informed is to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Kathy Reisowitz. Also check out my blog, Sex in the State. It's www.kathyreisowitz.com/blog. And yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you, Kathy. Thank you for coming on. I think this topic can become very uncomfortable, and it can oftentimes, like, I'm not a confrontational person, and so I tend to kind of wither in conversations like this, but I really enjoyed talking to you. I thought it was a great chat. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. I appreciate you being open-minded and being genuinely curious about these topics.
Thank you. And now for something completely different. It has come to my attention that there is a popular reality television show called The Bachelor. Not sure how long it's been on, probably 3 or 4 years. Regardless, I am offended that nobody has yet asked me to compete on it, because I would be great. And I'm a proactive kind of guy. So rather than just complaining, I am going to pitch myself to the producers of that program, because I don't know the figures on my podcast, but I assume about a quarter of the American population listens to it. So there's a pretty good shot that one of those producers is listening right now. So here's my pitch, Mr. or Miss Producer, to appear on The Bachelor. First, I'm a bachelor. Check. Second, I pass out roses to women all the time, which I am told is a staple of that program. I do that because I hate my neighbor Ted, and he has a rose garden in his front yard. So on the way to work every morning, I cut off any fresh roses that I see, and then I pass them out later at the gas station where I get my breakfast. Sometimes on weekends, I plant bamboo in Ted's yard. I'm not sure if bamboo is involved in The Bachelor, but if it is, I am 3 for 3 so far. Next, I love judging women. That seems integral to the show based on reviews I've read. I can do that, and I can do it hard. Sometimes I walk down the street, and I just shout things like, "You're too tall! Be shorter!" Or, "Hey, you, read more!" If offered a salary, I think I could really up my game on judging. Here's another great thing about me. I've been exonerated of all arsony charges. That's right, those various accusations that I set fire to a warehouse and collected the insurance money, dismissed. Or that lawsuit claiming it was me who set Ted's rose garden on fire, mistrial. Do any other prospective bachelors have a not an arson certificate hanging on their wall? I doubt it. Finally, I have to think the point of The Bachelor is to pump sleep-deprived contestants full of booze and jealousy until they reach a psychological breaking point that's amusing for sadistic television viewers. I'm in. In fact, I am totally happy to kickstart some kind of sex cult if you think that'll do well in the ratings. And that's why you should consider me, Andrew Heaton, as the next bachelor on The Bachelor. Thank you. We're almost done, guys. We'll do a little bit of listener feedback before we kick it off. This is from iTunes, where you should review the podcast, particularly if you like it. If you don't like it, you should just email me and not go on iTunes. But if you like it, go on iTunes and review me. Ron23455. A lot of people don't know how many Rons there are. There are exactly 23,455 of them. Ron23455 said, "Incredible show and very refreshing. Heaton is engaging, smart, thoughtful, and generally someone I would love to have a pint with. Thank you, Ron. I appreciate that. I am a delightful person to have a pint with, as I'm sure are you. Thank you. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like Indiana Jones' best friend. And I gotta say, I've really upped my waistcoat game of late, and you are missing out if you're not seeing my fantastic outfits. So download the Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to the Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.